Welcome to Success Secrets, the podcast where we dive into the inspiring stories of individuals who have overcome obstacles and achieved remarkable success in their professional lives. Get ready to be inspired and discover their secrets to success. Today, we're joined by Roe Samuel, founder of Real Sport and Connected. Real Sport, which had over 8 million monthly users, was acquired in 2018. Roe then launched Connected to improve diversity and accessibility in startup funding. Since its launch, Connected has made over 30,000 connections, facilitated rapid fundraisings, including 1.5 million in 6 days, supported over 1,200 funding rounds, expanded to a team of 80 plus, achieved 4 times annual recurring revenue growth for 3 years, and raised over 8.5 million in seed funding. Let's dive into Roe's journey and his success secrets. Hi, Roe. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Lestelle. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming on. It is Roe, right? I just wanted to confirm.
Do you know, it's actually pronounced Roy, but I get everything under the sun, as you can imagine. And it's really up for interpretation. It's funny. I think it actually means that it's a Dutch verb to row. So I've had a lot of Dutch people reaching out to me who are like trying to get in touch with like rowing organizations in the Netherlands with my Twitter handle. But other than that, yeah.
That's so funny. Well, I'm not going to lie. I actually Googled how to pronounce Roe before, and it was like, it came up as like a Jewish name as well, Hebrew.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It also comes up as like Portuguese, Afrikaans. Yeah, so it's definitely open to interpretation.
Love it. Very cool. So yeah, it's great to have you on the podcast. I know it's been a couple of years now since I was on yours. So now the tables have turned and I get to be the one that questions you. So I'm excited about this.
Amazing.
So to start, can you tell me a bit more about yourself, your background and your inspiration behind founding your startup and what motivated you into the entrepreneurial landscape?
Yeah, of course. So I guess I was involved with entrepreneurial activities from a pretty young age, originally trying to build computers in the bedroom to sell them, failed miserably at that, then started getting into online content, digital content creation. So always involved with technology and just at a time where people were really starting to pay attention to that. So I started at university building out a platform to help students create online content, taking a lot of those skills I developed quite early and then transitioning that into an online platform. And we rolled out in about 8 or 9 different universities throughout the UK. And it was great and it was really fun. We were running student nights, running trips, and we were running all this online content. But advertisers didn't care about students because they got no money to spend and students didn't want to spend any money. So we then pivoted that business into a sports platform. So helping sports fans, gaming fans create online content, podcasts, videos, other types of content, giving them tools to optimize that content for social, which is obviously very standard now, but quite leading edge back in 2013 when we took it to market. And we got really fortunate with that because it was just at a time when sports journalism was having a big renaissance on Twitter and just after Twitch had launched. So lots of people using our tools for those platforms. We ended up working with some of the biggest sports rights holders in the world, the NBA, the NFL, the Premier League, and scaled that business to about 8 million monthly users. Really, really exciting journey. We were acquired by a gaming company called Gfinity in 2018. And off the back of that, started investing in startups and advising startups. And with the companies that I was investing in and advising, I could see a really strong positive correlation between specific behaviors those startups were making and the outcomes they were having in terms of performance, in terms of growth, and in terms of transactions. Those behaviors were really investor reporting, financial reporting, and access to expert networks. So we started to build out Connected, which is my current business, which is helping everyone in the startup ecosystem. So the startups, the investors, and the experts take part in those behaviors in as frictionless, seamless, and accessible way as possible.
Wow, that's a really cool journey. And I can see, like, from your mind, you've managed to see the pain points in different areas that, and you're like, oh, actually, there's a pain point here and I can build a business around that. And that's a need that the market has. And then obviously that's how you create your success. So I find that really cool. And regarding your previous business, I saw that you had 8 million monthly users. That's amazing. How old were you when you first started it?
So I was 21 when we started that business. So still at uni, I'm doing that alongside my degree, which was part of the ADHD brain thing, right? You can never have enough stimulation, as we were discussing before. And then we sold that when I was 27, I guess.
Wow, that's really cool. And then how long did you wait until you started Connected?
So I started investing in startups pretty much immediately after the exit. And I went through a 12-15 month period where I was like, I'm not going to do Startup Founder again. I just thought I'm going to invest. I did stand-up comedy for like 18 months. I was training every day. I was like, this is my life. This is it. And then, you know, very, very quickly, I was like, yeah, no way. No way is that going to happen. So just started looking at different options, started looking at opportunities, saw what was going on with my portfolio companies. And just as you said, Lisel, it was all about identifying a need with, because I think when I was a first time founder, I didn't really get involved in the startup community. Mm-hmm. You know, I think as a first time founder, like you're just focused on building, you know, it's almost like you don't even get your head above the parapet. But then when I started investing and advising, then I could see the broader ecosystem in a bit more of a powerful way or a bit more of a meaningful way, I guess. And that's when, you know, Connect, the first wheels of Connected started turning, probably about after 6 months. And then we incorporated the company, I guess it was like 18 months after we sold Real Sports. So yeah, that sort of gap.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. Well done. And onto your ideas. I have an interesting question. So how do you tend to generate your new ideas? Where do your best ideas come from?
That's a good question. Where do the best ideas come from? I think walking, I know that's such a strange answer, but like, I feel like the brain is so amazing at background processing. And in many ways, like the best answers won't come immediately. It's about absorbing that information, letting your brain take it all in, and then let the background processing do its work. So I think walking is great for that. Exercise is great for that. And then when you come back and try and tackle that problem, it's almost like so much of it has happened subconsciously, which is amazing. I mean, the human brain is just incredible when you think about it that way. So I think that's really useful. And then I think, you know, that's why sounding boards are really important. You know, there are so many times where, and just listening as well, there are so many times where, you know, we've got amazing advisors at Connected, amazing investors at Connected, where we'll be having a problem and I'll just be catching up with people and I'll say certain things and that just unlocks like, oh, you know, they might be talking about something totally different, but actually the way of thinking that they had about a certain problem or situation, applying that to what's going on with you. So I think it's background processing and I think it's just really listening to the people around you. I think one of the hardest things that any founder needs to do, and I'm sure you found this as well, Lisel, is figuring out who to take advice from, who to trust. Mm. There's no shortage of advice out there, right? There's no shortage of people giving you their opinions. Figuring out who you should really listen to, that's the key thing, but that will help massively with ideas.
I love that you've said that because I actually write a lot on taking advice. So one of my favorite sayings, actually it's my saying, is, don't take advice from people who aren't where you want to be. And if they are giving you advice, take it with a pinch of salt. So like you have to really filter it, right? Because like you said, everyone wants to give their advice, but not everyone is going to give the advice that you need to get to that next level. So yeah, that's my saying.
Totally. I think that's a great saying. And I think it's why it's so important. I know both me and you do this, which is being really transparent about where we are in our business. We started this conversation by having, well, we had this challenge, we had that challenge. It's not like, yeah, everything's perfect all the time. It's about having that transparency. And I think that allows people listening to us to say, okay, this advice is relevant to me or not. You know, I see founders who have had, you know, one failed pre-seed startup and now they're, you know, advisors on LinkedIn and they're like, you know, this is how you do this, this is how you do that. And it's like, okay, that's great that you want to help. And I think that's amazing. But I think you need to be transparent about where your skill set, where your expertise, where your experience got to, you know, because I think there's really important value for everyone, you know, from everyone. But, you know, you've got to be able to taper that by saying, okay, well, actually, at this point, if I'm a Series B founder, listening to a pre-seed founder isn't necessarily going to help me. But if that person's holding himself as like a, you know, founder has been there, done that, then maybe I'm starting to take the wrong advice.
Yeah, that's very true. And yeah, I think you have to listen to the experts in where you want to be as well. And actually, I wrote something about, there was this article that I did the other day about 20 investments that are going to help propel startups forward. And the one that I put was investing in yourself and your personal development. And I put, it's all about learning from the best in the game, from the people that have tried, failed, and succeeded, because you're going to learn from their mistakes and you're going to get there a lot quicker as well.
100%. Love that.
So also onto another question. Obviously, during entrepreneurship, there's a lot of roller coasters that go on. I know we spoke about earlier this year where we had some issues, obviously a downturn in revenue and everything like that. So how do you deal with fear and doubt in the business when things start to go a bit downhill?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So we, in February this year, we ran some experiments that we felt we wanted, you know, we had to do to understand, actually it was around price validation a bit more. And they didn't work really. So I think the way to deal with fear and uncertainty really speaks to your ability to measure as a business. When things are happening that we don't understand, that's super scary, right? When it's like, okay, we don't know why things are going wrong, and therefore we don't know what to change in order to get back to where we need to be. So I think that's why baking in methods of measurability from as early on as possible is so important for a growing business. And I think that's why I would say that the biggest gap between startups who go from seed to series A, or even if not from a fundraising perspective, who make that leap from, let's say, like $500,000 ARR to $5 million ARR, is actually based around the quality of their data collection. Because you're always going to have these challenges, always going to have things that go wrong. And if you're just looking at things as one lump, how are you ever going to unpack what went wrong in that situation? So for us, you know, I would say from the time someone sees an asset through to them churning as a customer, you know, that entire lifetime cycle, we probably have 100 modules along the way, which we can always change and optimize and iterate. Where did things go wrong? Where can things improve? Where do we need to improve products? Where do we need to improve marketing? Where, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. So I think probably a rule for me for any element of life is how do we deal with anxiety is being proactive. You know, I think it's the same thing like mental health, right? Is, you know, let's train every day, or let's stay on top of things. Let's keep ourselves moving, because actually that's going to get ahead of problems before they arise. So it's the same with collecting data. I think that's probably the best way for me for being able to help my team and help myself navigate fear is saying, well, we're going to understand as much as possible within our grasp, and then know that we can make the changes as and when.
Nice. So it's about being proactive and consistent and doing everything in your power, like what the power in your hands that you have to do it right. It's not like control the controllables is what you're saying.
Totally exactly that. And you've got to be stoic with these things, right? It's just, yeah, you know, there's so much within our realm, there's so much within our control or ability to try and influence, and there's plenty outside of that, which that's the luck element of business, right? Mm-hmm. I think anyone who's been successful or had some level of success will realize you've got to attribute a lot to what was out of your control in terms of that luck part. But you know, you can't rely on that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, luck obviously comes in when you have that hard work and consistency, and preparation meets luck essentially at the end, hopefully anyway. So you just have to do everything in your power to create those opportunities for you. And one of my favorite sayings as well is, don't wait for opportunity, create it. So you always have to be creating your own opportunities, meeting new people, getting yourself out there, connecting, analyzing everything that you can to create that success for you in the future and create those opportunities.
Totally. Is that, what would you say is the best way of making opportunities come to you, rather than, you know, what's the most proactive way that you can generate opportunities, would you say?
Oh, I mean, I like to personally, so I'll go to a lot of in-person industry events. So for example, I'm speaking at IFX International in Cyprus. And I think that's a great way to get in front of my target audience. So there's a lot of CFD brokers there. And for them, seeing me as a speaker, and seeing me on the website, and I'm going to be on their social media, like the pages, social media and everything, that again builds my credibility and trust for my business, and it puts me in front of my audience. So that's again me being creating that opportunity to be in front of them. That's one of the areas. Yeah, what about you?
Nice. No, I love that. I think it's there's very little that can match in-person meeting, right? And I think it's so important. I wish I did more of it, to be honest. Maybe I'll take some inspiration from this, LaSalle, and I'll start doing a bit more. But I also think the online version of that, right? Brand building. Mm-hmm. You know, what can you do from a content perspective to put it out there, to be seen in that way? So yeah, I think that's it. It's about getting yourself out there by whatever means necessary, in person, online. But I think it all comes down to, and I know you're so good at this and you're a champion of this, is self-belief. I think the thing which holds back the most entrepreneurs, I think it's why the US is so much further ahead than the UK on this, is being able to tap into that self-belief to put yourself out there. I meet so many amazing people who I just think if you had the ability to just unlock that confidence that you deserve because you know your stuff so well, you know, like how far much further could you be in that way? And I think that's a really key skill for anyone who wants to build something really big is backing yourself, you know?
Backing yourself, yeah. And I think, I mean, I actually know, you know as well, that a lot of people struggle with that self-belief. Maybe it's from programming, growing up, being told that you can't do this, you can't do that, or from people around you because they're already, maybe they have already negative mindset and stuff like that. So it takes a lot of reprogramming in your mind. And this is what I learned, like, for example, when I was 18, I was just always reading self-help books. And when I was growing up, I had a very negative mindset. So I realized that actually I have to reprogram my mind. And it is possible to change your mindset. You just have to work on it every single day.
100%. It's like it's the same thing as saying it's never too late to start working on fitness. You could start when you're 50. You know, it's the same thing. It's going to be harder the later you start, for sure. But it's always there for you. And you can make significant improvements in, you know, and it's ultimately like, it's funny, I think with the prevalence now of like neuroscience and content around that, it's great because we're able to apply a more academic layer to what we're talking about. Previously, even 5 years ago, someone would hear this conversation and would be like, oh, this is some pseudo spiritual, like, you know, mindset stuff. Exactly. Whereas now, actually, the science of neuroplasticity is so prominent and people so understand that that's really what we're talking about here. It's not something which comes from the cosmos. I mean, that might be a separate conversation, but something that really is within our control in order to improve the way that we think about opportunities and put ourselves out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And but I love that you mentioned the neuroscience part of that, because a couple months ago I did a TEDx talk about the mindset and neuroplasticity and how it's like clay in our own hands, shapeable by our own thoughts and beliefs. So it's all about retraining your mind and reshaping it to how you want it to be. And it's so important. Yeah.
So from your, let's give a little advert here for your TEDx talk. What were your top thoughts?
Oh, okay. I put, one of my best things that I put was dream big, make a plan and take action. And when you opt for an I can over an I can't, you're not just setting yourself up for success. You're reshaping your mind towards achieving your dreams. So it's just all about telling yourself every day that I can do this. I can do this. I believe in myself. I've got what it takes. And eventually you really start to believe that as well.
Yeah, amazing. Love that.
Yeah. And actually, I also have another question regarding your business. So what type of company, because obviously people that are looking to start their business, a lot of them would think, okay, if I'm going to start a business, then I need to raise money to get it to be successful and everything like that. But obviously not all businesses need to have investment. So what would you say is, how would you decide if a company should go for investment or not?
That's a great question. Yeah, it's a great question. And you are 100% right that investment is potentially a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And I see so many founders talking about raising a VC round as almost like that's the goal, rather than that might help you along the way to a goal. And I think that's the key thing. So I think the first thing is all about, what do you genuinely want as a startup founder or as a business owner, let's say? Are you looking for a business that's going to give you a great lifestyle and that's going to pay your way, and it's something you're passionate about and can see yourself working in it for 30 years and then great. That's one type of business. Is this a business that you think is a global business which you don't want to have control of, but you want to just see in the world, and you want to really solve a massive problem with global reach, global ambition that's going to genuinely be in 15 years' time of business generating £250 million a year, you know, where you own a small percentage of that and, you know, it's a totally different type of business where your life is no longer your life. Your life is your business, mm-hmm. you know? So that's just two ends of the spectrum. And there's so much in between that. I think that's always the starting point. What do you genuinely want? And then I think the second point is a lot of people say they genuinely want the latter, but without realizing what the latter means. And that's in terms of, well, what does it take to build that type of business? What does it take to fund that type of business? And what your life really looks like when you're building that type of business. So I think it's all about understanding the realities, understanding the ambition, and understanding the input too. You know, I think we've glamorized venture-backed businesses for a long time, and that's great. But I think the most glamorous businesses are businesses which allow business owners to retain a good work-life balance, which mm-hmm. funds their lifestyle and allows them to run the way that they want to run. So I think it totally depends on that.
Nice. And what kind of business lifestyle would you say you have right now?
It's a good question. I mean, Connected is a venture-backed startup, right? And it is one that's trying to grow that way. So we grew 4x year on year for the first 3 years. We grew 2.5x last year. We'll grow 2.2x this year. So we're pushing the boundaries constantly. And in order to achieve that sort of growth, you're betting the house so much. So I'll give you a good example of that. And this is the sort of thing that you need to do with a venture-backed mindset rather than a lifestyle mindset, is we, in order to continue achieving the growth rate that we want to achieve, we're thinking about not just how do we grow this year, we're thinking about what do we do now that's going to sustain this 2 to 2.5x growth over 25 and 26. So growing your business as usual 2.5x in 1 year is tough enough. Doing that whilst also building out the mechanisms for 2.5x the year after and the year after, so tackling geographic expansion and diversification of product stream, as well as growing BAU 2.5x at the same time, is the sort of chaos that you need to go into and the sort of betting the house that you need to do in order to go on that venture back journey. So that means, like, you know, we're operating on two time zones. We're speaking to whole new my life is business, right? It's getting to a stage now, and it took 3 years to get to a stage where, yeah, look, I'm still up at 6 a.m. every morning. But rather than being at my desk at 6:15, now it's like, okay, I can get to the gym, so I can be at my desk at 7:45. But it's still that type of, you know, 85, 90% work, 10% life. But I love it. You know, I genuinely love it. And if I thought for a second that I wouldn't be enjoying that, or if I didn't think that was the right journey for me, it wouldn't be the right thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I see what you mean as well. And obviously you already exited a business and you were like, oh, actually, you probably missed that entrepreneurial life and getting your hands stuck in and getting into the grip of things. Because it's also a lifestyle, isn't it? Being an entrepreneur and having your business. It's like having a baby. And if you're passionate about it, then it's so much fun. When you see it grow, when you see the success, you're like, oh yeah, what can I do next? What can I do more that's going to see more growth? How big can I take this? It's an exciting journey, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. What about you? What does work life look like right now?
Oh, I would say I think my business model for what I'm aiming for is quite different to yours. I've been running my business now for over 5 years, and like I have the beauty of being able to travel all over the world. So all our company is remote based. I mean, I do go and see my team in Portugal and in the UK quite a lot. But yeah, I built my business around my lifestyle, essentially. The funny thing is, I first realized I wanted to have this type of business when I quit my corporate job in the city in London and went traveling around Southeast Asia. So then I was like, okay, how can I fit something around my lifestyle that's going to allow me to make good money, a lot of money, and also travel the world at the same time? So I'm very fortunate to have this business, and yeah, it's also allowed me to go into other ventures as I was talking about before. I do property development and investing, so that's been really fun, and I'm very passionate about that too.
Amazing. No, 100%. And I think certainly the next thing I do after Connected, but look, you know, we're so at the start of the Connected journey, which is amazing, but probably post Connected, yeah, whether I decide to go, you know, to try and build a venture-backed business again or do something different remains to be seen. I mean, look, we're both fortunate to be super young, right? Mm-hmm. And in many ways, like, you know, this is all about learning right now. It's all, for me, it's all about being a sponge and just learning from people like you and learning from other entrepreneurs mm-hmm. about all the different types of businesses available to me. Because I think that's another thing is, you know, so my dad was a bus driver. My mum was a primary school teacher. You know, I did not understand what building a business in today's world meant by any means. And I was very, very fortunate. My first business, my co-founder's brother, who was 3-4 years older than us or whatever, he had gone down the venture back journey, and it was the first person I'd ever met or been exposed to had done that. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know anyone. There was no one in my network who had done that before. Speaking to your point earlier about how important it is to learn from people who are where you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was that. And it was, you know, he had raised like 10 million in venture capital for like a series A for that business. And just seeing that, I was like, oh, this whole route is open to me in a way that I never even knew existed before. And now over the last few years, we're speaking to more and more business owners and looking at other ways. And like, you know, Simon Squibb is a good friend, such a proponent of this, talking about, I mean, look, his life is all business and he loves that. But, you know, talking about, you know, different ways of running businesses shouldn't all be investment based. A lot of them should be, you know, lifestyle businesses in that way, which I think is amazing. And that's it. It's about just getting as much exposure as possible to all these great ways of running your life, running your venture, and learning from there.
Yeah, I think that's very great as well. I think it's so important also before going into this journey to define, okay, what type of business that you were, like you mentioned, and then building it around that as well, because that's what's ultimately going to be the most rewarding for you. And that's where you're going to put the most effort and passion is going to come out of it as well. So that's an important note as well. If someone's looking to start their business, know what you're going in there for as well.
Yeah, totally. And I would also say, don't be afraid to reach out to someone who is in the position that you want to be in. Send out 10 messages. Yeah, listen, you know, maybe only 3 are going to respond to you, but 2 of those are going to have a call with you. And I try and do that all the time, like as much as possible. Someone reaches out, hey, you know, I've got this idea, or I'm in this, you know, situation, I don't know what to do, can you help me out? Always happy to try and help wherever. And yeah, I think people who have, you know, made it to a certain level or had some success, they're normally more than happy to try and help if they've got time.
Yeah, that's so true. And actually, a lady I spoke to at the Forbes 30 50 Summit, she was like this very successful 50 over 50. And I asked her what advice she would give to the younger people. And she said, help everyone as much as you can, because it will come back to you in tenfold. So is it, the more you give out, the more love and everything else that you give out to the world, the more you're going to get back in return.
Yeah, I totally buy it.
I also wanted to ask you, how do you define success? Because everyone has their own definition of success. And what maybe my definition is probably different to yours. So how would you define it?
That is a great question. And I think success has evolved as a concept for me over my life. I think, you know, when you do grow up in an environment where actually maybe having the material things that people around you have, not having the material things that people around you have, maybe that creates a quite capitalistic view of success quite early on, because I think it becomes like, if I can buy those things, I can have those things, then I'll feel successful. And I think a lot of people start off with that sort of level of success. And then I think it changes. I think you realize pretty early on, it's fairly empty. You know, I remember post-exit, there were some moments in my life where it was like, oh, this will be the happiness, like this will be the success, feeling of success. You know, this weekend in Vegas, this weekend in Shanghai, whatever it is. It's like, yeah, cool, I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to feel, you know, great, I got everything I needed from it. And then you're there and it's like, it's so existentially disappointing because you're like, oh, this is so empty. So I think, you know, you go through those changes. I think now where I am with success, and I don't want to sound pretentious in any means by this, but I genuinely think the only reason why you have good luck, and there's been so much luck in my journey, so much luck, is if there's going to be a reason for you to use that to empower and help other people along the way. Like the only reason that I've been given some of the opportunities, some of the chances that I have, surely must be to then try and funnel that out into broader good in that way. So I think certainly long-term goal is to try and help as many people as possible, and that will be success for me, is am I able to do more good than was done for me in that way? Which pretty much echoes what that woman who you just mentioned before, I can't remember her name, sorry, said at the summit. But yeah, that's how I see it now. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I love being able to give back to like you mentioned, because it also makes me feel good inside that I'm able to help others achieve their dreams and success. So for example, and we actually spoke about this in your podcast, at the beginning of my career journey, I was the only woman in the company on the trading floor, and I didn't really have any other women to speak to or look up to. And I'm trying to be that person, that woman that other young women in the industry or just starting their business can come to whenever, and just reach out and feel like they can talk to me about anything. Because it really does help. And it's nice for them to know that they're not alone in this and that they can do it too. That's what I'm trying to give out, like for them to know that they can achieve anything that they want to.
Amazing.
Yeah. that's how I would define success for me, and also being able to live life on my own terms as well. So like you mentioned at the beginning, I thought, okay, maybe if I have these beautiful shoes, my Louboutins, nice bags, and everything like that, then I'll be happy. And I got those and I'm like, doesn't really make me happy. And then I bought a really nice house in Portugal, and obviously it was so beautiful, but it still wasn't making me happy. And then I just completely, like, for example, last year I did a whole 180 on my lifestyle, and now I'm just a full-time traveler. So I literally just go, I'll do 3 months here in Thailand. I'll do like 2-3 months in South America. I'm going to be in Europe in Barcelona in the summer. So that for me is how I feel happy every day, knowing that I'm getting to explore the world and try different cultures. And just that's for me is like my true genuine self.
Yeah. Love that. Sounds good. That sounds like a plan.
Yeah. It's a great plan. Great plan. And on to, I know we spoke about this just before recording, and I think it's something that we both struggle with, ADHD. And it's something that I often don't talk about, but I see you often talking about it on LinkedIn, and I do salute you for that, because for me specifically, whenever I mention I have ADHD, it's kind of like swept under the rug by people, and not really like I almost feel ashamed of having it. So how do you think your ADHD has impacted you and your business and how are you managing it all?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and sorry to hear that that's been your experience as well. That's a shame, you know, especially in 2024, right? Well, I think there's a really interesting stat that was told to me by a guy called John Abel. John is the technical director of the CTO's office for Google UK. Super smart guy. And he's also on the board of the British Dyslexic Association, talking about neurodiversity. And I think it was like the prevalence of neurodiversity within the tech ecosystem in the UK is 2.5 times higher than it is in the general population. But the prevalence of neurodiversity in the prison population in the UK is 5 times higher. So for me, what that says is the ability to manage ADHD, for example, or the lack of ability or the inability to manage that can lead you down two very, very different paths. And I think a lot of that, at least the way that I've come to understand that through my own journey and lots of people that I've seen around me, is ADHD specifically requires dopamine in order for the ADHD brain to focus, right? Now, dopamine can be achieved through lots of different means, some of them very positive, some of them very negative. It's another reason why the rate of addiction in adults with ADHD is so high. It's something like over 50% of adults with ADHD have suffered with addiction problems at some point in life, because wow, the only way to feel normal is through dopamine. You know, another great way of getting dopamine is risk. What's a great way of getting risk? Entrepreneurialism, right? So if you are in a situation where it's like, okay, entrepreneurism, big decisions, we talk about betting the house, this, that, you know, all the rest of it, high stakes, high pressure, that's where we thrive. You know, so if you're in an entrepreneurial environment, ADHD, very, very positive, because actually in moments of high risk and high stress, when most people crumble, we go into focus mode. It's like, cool, hyperdrive. And that's such a powerful thing. So that's why I think there is so much linking between ADHD and entrepreneurialism. So why I want to talk about ADHD a lot and why I think it's so important to get the message out there is if you are aware that you have ADHD at a younger age, you can then channel it into something like entrepreneurialism rather than going down a bad route. So when I was 14, I was on the verge of being kicked out of school. 13, 14, I was on the verge of being kicked out of school because I was going down the bad route. Got very, very lucky, very, very fortunate that I managed to get the ADHD diagnosis, understand my brain. And don't get me wrong, like the understanding we have now and the things that I'm talking about now, 18 years later, 19 years later, is not how mature the understanding was back then. So these are things that I figured out along the way. But by understanding, okay, ADHD, different ways of working, you have to change things slightly, that allowed me to then unlock all the things that we're talking about. So that's why I think it's so important to put out there.
Wow. Yeah, I love that you've mentioned all of this. And now you've definitely inspired me to start talking out and speaking out about it more as well. I actually had a lot of issues at school as well. I almost get kicked out too. And I was going down that wrong route. But I don't know, something in my mind switched when I was about 18 and said, okay, no one is coming to save me but myself. So that's when I started to pick things back up and I got my job in finance. But it wasn't actually until I was actually only last year where I was diagnosed with severe ADHD. But all throughout my life, my friends around me were like, oh, you've got ADHD, you're super ADHD. So I knew that I had it, but I just got the official diagnosis last year. So yeah, it's been interesting and it's allowed me to also have peace of mind knowing that, okay, I'm like this and how can I manage it better? And there's also a lot of positives to it, right? Like you mentioned, in entrepreneurship, you have high stakes, you have that risk and it's exciting. It does give you that dopamine. So it actually allows us to excel in the entrepreneurship realm. And also it's very creative too. I feel like my brain can be very creative. I feel like I'm sure you are the visionary of your business, as I am too. It allows us to come up with strategies and new ideas that are really going to help move the business forward that maybe some different type of brain wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I think that's so right. And I think it's interesting you mentioned about the school stuff because I think that's it. I think if you've got ADHD and or actually any type of neurodiversity, let's say, and school doesn't work for you, you're going to go down the route of like, okay, I can't do something normal. I can't fit in school. School doesn't work for me. So how am I going to be a lawyer? How am I going to be a doctor? How am I going to do any of those things? And if you don't show kids who just don't fit the normal education system, that's not because they're not normal. It's just because education is, you know, the way that it is. If you don't show them, well, actually, you can go down this route. You can do the entrepreneurial thing. You can be involved in these types of projects or businesses or creatives. Then almost you're forcing them to exit the system and nearly get kicked out of school because you're just saying, this is normality. You don't fit in this box. So where do I go as a kid? Where do I go? Of course, I'm going to start getting involved with all sorts of things outside of school because I'm being told, you know, this is the normal route and you don't fit in it. So I think, and I also think that prevalence of ADHD will only increase over time because I think ADHD can be something you're born with, but I also think it's something you might develop. And I don't know, like, I don't think there's enough study about this, but I think the dopamine addiction created by consumer-facing technology right now will mimic the impact of ADHD.
Yeah.
Even though it won't be actual ADHD in that way, they will mimic the impact of ADHD because then you're going to get this, well, low dopamine, I can't focus, I'm not interested. But so even though it's not real ADHD, the symptoms.
Yeah, definitely. And I have to agree with social media and everything because it makes you're chasing that dopamine all the time. And I read an article that, you know, like Instagram, for example, and LinkedIn and everything else, they created the scrolling. So it's like a slot machine, you know, when you're in a casino. So because you always want to go down. So it's an addiction.
100%. I mean, I don't know if you've like games like Candy Crush are literal crack. I mean, in terms of what they do to the brain. It's exactly that. It's literally the same. It's the same type of dopamine payoff, same type of like gratification payoff, which is associated with the most addictive behaviors. So, you know, it's no surprise to me that so many, you know, executives who have worked on social media platforms do not let their kids have phones, do not let their kids on social media to a certain age. And I think that's something we all need to look at.
Yeah, for sure. Because children will become addicted so quickly. Like, You give a child an iPad at five, they're going to be screaming for their iPad all the time.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you know, we have, and I don't want to say anything controversial here, and certainly I will say easy for me to say who doesn't have kids, but I certainly do notice that there's probably a trend of parenting by algorithm, you know, because it's easier to look after a child by giving the iPad. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, when the child is so impressionable at an early developmental age, then what's the impact of that going to be? It's not to say it's a bad thing. But we certainly don't understand the impacts of that. And what does it mean when children's brains are so informed by algorithm rather than by life and parenting?
Outside world.
We don't know the outcomes of that yet. We'll know them in 20 years, but it's certainly different to what's happened throughout the rest of human history for hundreds of thousands of years, where parenting is a, you know, involved process in that way rather than maybe a somewhat delegated process. But I don't want to say anything controversial.
all good. No, I agree with you there for sure. Okay, we're just coming to the last couple of questions of the podcast. So one of my favorite questions, and it's something very close to my heart that I love to ask all my guests. So diversity and inclusion has become increasingly important topics in the workplace. How do you prioritize diversity and inclusion within your organization?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I would lie if I said it was something that we did day one. You know, and I think we suffered the impacts of that later on down the line. I think we've done a lot to redress it versus where we were. But certainly, I think we didn't focus on that at an early stage. And that was not a good thing to do and something we've learned from. You know, I think it's important to be honest about these things. We did have, so my COO, my first employee, Claudia, obviously is a female leader, has been amazing, and that's been great. But we didn't bake in D&I early on. And I think it's because we didn't really bake in a strong hiring process early on. I think there's so much that can be done within the hiring process to make sure that you are, you know, leveling the playing field as much as possible, really opening up opportunity to everyone in a way that the traditional hiring models don't really allow for. And we've brought in a lot of those, and that's seen massively, big improvements in the diversity within our organization. But I don't think it's something we focused on since day one. Now that we have more diverse hiring managers, I think that's probably been the biggest impact. You know, and I think that's a really powerful way of ensuring that you have as much representation during the hiring process as possible. And certainly that's changed a lot for our business over time. But yeah, you know, holding my hands up, I don't think it's something we put enough emphasis on early on. But yeah, for us, you know, more diversity in hiring managers, totally taking lots of advice and actually bringing in, you know, outside advisors to us on diversity, helping redress that hiring process has been really important.
Oh, fantastic. That's great to hear. And it's great to hear how you're so honest about, okay, at the beginning, not so much, but now you know that there's benefits to it and you are doing as much as you can. So as long as we're going in the right direction, then yeah, I think that's amazing.
Yeah, totally. 100%. And I think that's just the reality of any startup is there's so much really important stuff that you don't focus on day one. Because, you know, you just don't necessarily have the bandwidth to do that. But then as soon as you're able to, you must.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sort of thing, right?
For sure, for sure. And onto my last favorite question. So if you could go back to your 21-year-old self and tell them anything, what would you tell them?
Go back, my 21-year-old self. Well, where was I at 21? Okay, I was just, so what's, oh God, I'm sounding old when I'm struggling. That would have been like 2012. Yeah, I mean, 2012. We were just starting. We're just starting working on real sport and real talk and all that. I think, yeah, I would say start therapy earlier. Would be a good one. I started therapy seriously at like 27, 28. Wish I'd started earlier. But I think the other thing is work more on that confidence. Goes back to what we were saying at the start, that self-belief, that confidence.
Believing in yourself.
Yeah, just don't expect confidence to arrive with you one day. Confidence is something you've got to work on. You've got to put yourself in situations, put yourself out there, because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You won't just wake up. I think when I was, especially when I was like 15, 16, you know, I think especially then, like you almost, you know, expect that, oh, when I'm older, I'll be more confident, you know, and that will come to you. But it's something that you can actively make happen by working on it. So I guess that's those are the two things I wish I started earlier: therapy and working on self-confidence. There you go.
I love that. And I think those two go hand in hand as well, because when you start therapy, that's when you'll be able to start building more confidence and self-assurance in yourself as well. So yeah, those are great tips for younger people and for yourself as well. So amazing. Love that. Okay, so just coming to the end, and I have a couple of quick fun fire questions. Favorite quote?
Ooh, favorite quote. That's such a tough one. I'm just going to go super cheesy with this, but it is true. It's you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Love it.
You know what? It's really so cheesy, but it's so true, right? So that true. Is the reality. And I think especially as like entrepreneurs, especially if you're just starting your business, it's the mindset you need to adopt. For and sure. I remember, for example, when I had Real Sport, we at that time, it's like I message every single contact of mine on Facebook. Do you know anyone who might be able to help me? Do you know any of this? And it's literally that. This mindset you have to adopt.
Love it. Yeah, just creating your own opportunities and getting out there. Favorite book?
Favorite book is The Growth Mindset by Caroline Dweck.
Amazing. Love that. Yeah, those great answers. Okay. So yeah, once again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show, and I'm sure all my listeners will love learning from you and hearing about your journey to success.
Amazing. Thanks so much for having me. It was really great to be on the show, and I look forward to listening back.
Me too. All right. Bye.